Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. WNYC, and there are geniuses among us. The 2020 MacArthur Fellows were named a couple of weeks ago. That's the official designation of this group of, quote, exceptionally creative individuals, as they say, but they are better known as MacArthur Genius Grants, and our listening area is home to quite a few of them, as it turns out. So all this week on the Brian Lehrer Show, we have lined up a genius a day to end the show with. Five newly minted Genius Prize winners, one to end the show with each day this week, beginning right now with N.K. Jameson of Brooklyn, who was honored, to quote what the MacArthur Foundation had to say, for, quote, pushing against the conventions of epic fantasy and science fiction genres while exploring deeply human questions about structural racism, environmental crises, and familial relationships, unquote. In her most recent novel, The City We Became, the boroughs of New York City are each embodied in a person, so five people representing the diversity and politics of their homes, who have to fight off a kind of across-the-multiverse threat of annihilation that manages to incorporate gentrification and something that we might say is like the Proud Boys. The name of her 2018 short story collection tells us a lot about her approach to fantasy and science fiction. It's titled How Long Till Black Future Month. Welcome, N.K. Jameson. Thanks for coming on and sharing your genius. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
And I'll tell folks you use your initials N.K. for writing, but your first name is actually Nora, which I gather you use in conversation. You want to tell people why your initials for your writing?
Just when I first started writing or starting to get published in the 90s, The use of initials was a good way to actually separate my real name from my writing name. That was back before Google and, you know, natural language processing. And NK worked because it was what my mom used to call me when I was in trouble. So I would respond to it, but not quite to the same degree that I would to my name.
Well,
that
you are now the opposite of in trouble. Congratulations. As a writer of fantasy, had you ever imagined winning a Genius Award for that?
I mean, you know, it was a pie in the sky kind of thing. Sure, maybe one day, because Octavia Butler, famously within our genre, won one back in the, I want to say, the late 80s for her work as a science fiction writer. So, of course, you know, every science fiction and fantasy writer has this sort of vague dream of getting that kind of success, but we don't usually expect it. So I was super surprised.
And you imagine New Yorkers having to join forces and do battle to protect their city for your latest novel, The City We Became. And it came out at the end of March, just as the pandemic was raging here. I don't know what that did to your book tour, but I suspect a lot of people read that book to help them imagine winning this struggle. Have you been hearing that?
Yeah, I was, you know, honestly expecting the book to kind of tank because, you know, coming out in the middle of the pandemic, I figured people would be more worried about other things than reading books. And yeah, we have seen, you know, some slumps in the book industry in a lot of ways and a lot of struggles just to get books to people. You know, there was a period there for a while where Amazon was kind of deprioritizing books in favor of making sure people had other things, which makes sense. And a lot of booksellers, especially indie booksellers, brick and mortar, had to go, you know, curbside pickup. But then, you know, as people started to read the book, as the reviews came out, it became clear that people were actually seeing some resonance with the pandemic in it. That I was not expecting, because there's a metaphor in the book for the viral encroachment of things like gentrification, and it works really well as a metaphor for a virus, too.
I guess. Yeah. Now, you said in your video for the MacArthur website that you're writing stories that you wish someone had written for you when you were younger. Yeah. What was missing?
A couple of things. One, the presence of people who looked like me. You know, science fiction and fantasy sort of prides itself on being very future forward, but in a lot of those futures, you saw mostly straight white male characters and kind of nobody else. And so that sort of suggested we weren't there in the future, and I didn't really like that. Or in the past, in the case of fantasy novels, you know, a lot of them were set in sort of this mythic past where I guess we were the myths. So that was a little uncomfortable. But the other piece of it was, that was missing was really just realistic engagement with the way that the world is. Yes, you're writing fantasy. That doesn't mean that you need to kind of make up a different behavior for humanity or a different way of interacting with the world for humanity. Humanity should still exist with all its warts and all its complexity and all of its diversity. And I wanted to see all of that. For good or for ill, but to me, that makes the fantasy go down easier if the people are real.
And so, given that you once you managed to get published, you went on to win 3 Hugo Awards in a row. For people who don't know, I think we can call that the Oscar of science fiction and fantasy. So, sure. Have things changed enough that younger versions of yourself wouldn't face those extra challenges in imagining and finding a publisher even?
There's still some difficulty in the industry. You know, systemic racism takes a while to kind of go away. We don't know how long because it hasn't happened. You know, I have heard from younger up-and-coming writers that they've been able to engage completely with subject matter that they might have hesitated to touch. You know, 10, 20 years ago, because, you know, now it's possible to speak openly about things like race and gender and other marginalizations. And, you know, as for whether it's easier for them to break in, it's kind of a two-edged thing. I am seeing a lot more writers of color coming in and being able to tell their own stories, which is wonderful. But at the same time, I'm hearing a few stories of like young black writers being told, write like N.K. Jemisin. And that makes me squinch. That makes me just
they should
cringe.
Write like themselves, right?
Yeah.
But a lot of people are happy that you write like N.K. Jemisin. So congratulations again on your MacArthur Fellowship, your Genius Award. N.K. Jemisin's latest novel is The City We Became, set right here in the 5 boroughs of New York. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Today we're joined by Cecile McLaurin-Selvant of Brooklyn, who was honored, to quote what the MacArthur Foundation had to say, for using manifold powers of interpretation to infuse jazz standards and original compositions with a vibrant global black feminist sensibility, unquote. So congratulations, Cecile, and thanks for coming on and sharing your genius.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I'm sure being called a genius must be welcome anytime, but in a year that has seen so much disruption in the performing arts, and before we play a little bit of your music, does this help?
It definitely helps. I mean, it's strange because it's also kind of a moment of reckoning because I don't necessarily identify with that word. But yeah, it's been a really strange year, especially because I haven't done a live performance since March. The last one was at Angela Davis's house in her living room with a 13-piece orchestra.
Wow.
So it's, yeah.
You'll have to get that new technology that lets players sync up without a delay and perform as an ensemble from their homes. But let's give the listeners a little sample of your work. for folks who aren't already fans, and they'll get here an idea of your wide vocal range, 4 octaves, really? And maybe even more expansive range in terms of musical genres. So this is 3 songs by other artists that you've performed live.
Like a fire burning beyond control, wild is love.
John Lewis, John Lewis, please tell me your mind. I will never do nothing for nobody, no time.
Okay, I'm going to go home now and just play your music for the rest of the show. No, I wish I could. So that was Wild is Love by Nat King Cole, the folk ballad Omi West, and Jim Crow era vaudevillian Burt Williams' signature song Nobody, little excerpts from those three. Is there a common thread there for you?
Well, I'm singing them, but other than that, I think all three songs surprised me, and that's what attracted me to them. You know, a song like Omi Wise is, it's a murder ballad. Wild is Love is this song about all the different places that love can take us, all the wild places. And Nobody is this really incredible comic, tragicomic masterpiece by the great Burt Williams. It's a song about caricature and stereotype and identity and lack, the feeling of lack. So I don't know. I think there's yearning in all three songs. I really am drawn to that feeling of yearning.
And listeners will play a little more Cecile McLaurin-Salvant music before we go out in this segment. But I guess to what you were just saying, you don't turn away from the racism and misogyny in our past. Do you see what you're doing as transformative or more simply trying to make sure we don't forget?
I think maybe there's a little bit of both. I have something in me that I really love to share forgotten gems with people, whether it's in music, film, or visual art. But I do like how it makes us question. I do like how looking at different eras, different cultures sort of make us question our own and how it rubs up against our own values and our own way of life.
I see that you also do visual art. What do you do?
I make really big drawings on silk. I embroider drawings of all kinds of things on silk organza. So they're kind of large scale textile works. And I do a little bit of animation. I'm actually working on a feature length animated film, which if we make it, will be the first animated feature film directed by a Black woman.
Wow. And I see that on Instagram. I mean, that's shameful that that would be a first at this point, right?
Isn't it?
But I see on Instagram that you've offered a line drawing for other people to color in.
Yes.
So what can people go do and participate in?
Yeah, I really like doing things collaboratively and seeing where people take my drawings and even my songs. I really want to start writing songs for other people, too, because so far it's mostly been me singing my own songs, but there's something really exhilarating about hearing your music or seeing your work in the hands of someone else.
Awesome. And you do write your own songs as well. We'll point out the medley we played was of older works. Do they range as widely as the genres that you choose from outside to sing?
I think so. I mean, I'm not sure, but I do. I was brought up in a really eclectic, a household with really eclectic taste, whether it was food or music or art or film. And I think that is reflected in what I'm drawn to and the way that I write and the way that I draw, for sure.
Well, congratulations again. As we say goodbye to MacArthur Fellow Cecile McLaurin-Salvant, and we bring in a little more of her music, this time an original called Fog, taken from an NPR Tiny Desk concert that she did. Congratulations, Genius. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Today, we're joined by documentary filmmaker Nanfu Wong of Montclair, who was honored, to quote what the MacArthur Foundation had to say, for creating intimate character studies that examine the impact of authoritarian governance, corruption, and lack of accountability on the lives of individuals, unquote. So, Nanfu, congratulations, and thank you for joining us and sharing your genius. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
And I see that you grew up in China, and two of your three documentaries are about policies there. The first, I will let our listeners know, Hooligan Sparrow, deals with sex workers and human rights violations. And your most recent film, One Child Nation, which won the Sundance Grand Jury Prize for documentaries as well, is a searing look at China's one-child policy that was in effect when you were born. So when you came to this country to study communications and eventually documentary filmmaking at NYU, did you have the aim of telling stories like those specifically?
Not really. It was all learned later. I was born and raised in China, and I moved to the U.S. in 2011 when I was 26. And at the time, I didn't know I was going to be a documentary filmmaker. I was hoping that I would be a journalist so that I could go back to China to report stories. And in the process of going to China in 2013 and following the women's rights activist, which is Hooligan Sparrow, that completely changed me. And I would say that was my political awakening process, because while making that film, I was surveilled by the Chinese government and they interrogated me, my family, my friends. And I witnessed a lot of the things that I wasn't aware of when I lived in China. So that really, I think, changed me and made me to be more politically aware. And that later led to the later films and my most recent film, One Child Nation, as well.
And One Child Nation covers a lot of devastation that the population control policy brought to bear collectively and individually, including in your own family. It's hard to watch at times because the stories of forced late-term abortions and sterilizations, abandonment of baby girls and seizure of infants is overwhelming and done on such a scale. But you as the filmmaker don't seem angry with the government so much as with everyone's acceptance that this was the way things were. Is that a fair understanding?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as a filmmaker, I've always been fascinated by how story would change based on who's telling it. Different people would experience the same issues, but see it in a very different way. So when we were making One Child Nation, the idea is to include as many different point of view as possible, and in order to understand such a complex issue. So we did go out and interview government officials, midwives who did a lot of abortions, and including victims, families too. And one thing that really surprised me was, initially we thought the government officials and the midwives, the doctors and nurses who did abortions, they were perpetrators. They were the bad people. But as soon as we met them and we realized this were people who were taking orders, and this were victims too. They've suffered from the guilt, the pain, and the trauma for decades, just as the women who had gone through the abortions and lost their children.
As you know, the politics of abortion and family planning here are different.
Yeah.
And some of the strongest critics of China's one-child policy in this country were those on the anti-abortion rights side of debates here. But you see that divide differently. How do you?
Yeah, I was very surprised when I came to the United States and learned that there is a restriction on abortions. I mean, on the surface, China and America looked very different, to a completely different political system. And the policies on abortions are very different, too. One is state-forced abortions, and another is certain states would restrict abortions. But I see them ultimately the same. because they are both the government trying to control women's bodies and trying to take away the choice from women. And that's something that I always was fascinated at, how two similarly different systems could have the same, you know, policy on that.
In the film, you share that your name, Nenfu, is the combination of the words for man and pillar. And it was the name intended for a son, but your parents gave it to you anyway in the hopes that you would grow up to be, quote, strong as a man. The sexism in that aside, the story of how you ended up in graduate school at NYU is a tale of strength, considering you were taken out of formal education when you were so young. You were in middle school. Can you share that story?
Well, it was a detour for sure. So I grew up in a very poor family in a remote village in China. And when I was 12, my father passed away, and I had to abandon my education so I could work to support my family and my younger brother, whom my family decided should be the one to go to school. And I worked for several years and saved money, and it took me a long time to eventually go back to school to continue my education. But I think all the early experience eventually contributed to the way that I looked at the world. And since then, I've focused my work on issues like injustice, corruption, freedom, surveillance, and other societal problems and its impact on individual lives.
So you've won this MacArthur Genius Grant, as it's known. Somebody once said, I've seen it attributed to F. Scott Fitzgerald, that genius is the ability to hold two seemingly contradictory views in mind and still function. So with China and the U.S. so much at odds, is that something you have to do in your work and maybe even in your family?
Absolutely. I feel when I explain what I do to my family and friends in China, it oftentimes would invite arguments and you know, fights sometimes. And there are a lot of things that, as just the one we talked about on the issues of abortion, that it looked different, but a lot is ultimately inherently similar in terms of disinformation and propaganda, which are the themes in One Child Nation, how the propaganda, the state propaganda, in a way, changed the narrative of how people see the One Child policy. And I think in the time that we currently live in, the disinformation and the propaganda exist in both countries, in different worlds. And that's something that I am personally fascinated and try to work on next, too.
And we will have to leave it there. Thank you, Nenfu Wang, now of Montclair, for talking about your 2020 MacArthur Genius Grant. I will note that One Child Nation is available to stream, listeners, on Amazon Prime. Thank you and congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Today, we are joined by Brooklyn writer Jacqueline Woodson, who was honored to quote what the MacArthur Foundation had to say for redefining children's and young adult literature to encompass more complex issues and reflect the lives of Black children, teenagers, and families, unquote. So congratulations. Welcome back. Thank you for joining us today and sharing your genius, Jacqueline Woodson.
Thanks, Brian. I'm glad to be here again.
And in your case, that joins a long list of other honors, like the Hans Christian Andersen Award for Lifetime Achievement in Children's Literature, given out by a queen, no less. This one comes with a cash grant and the genius word. Does it feel special in a certain particular way?
It feels special in that it's the MacArthur, I mean, which is so legendary to so many of us in this way that, you know, maybe we know someone who's gotten it before, or we just heard of it. And anything that attaches the word genius to you makes you feel some kind of way, I have to say.
I could ask you to read a little from your work, but on your website, you have kindly posted a video of Alicia Keys doing just that when she nominated your memoir in verse, Brown Girl Dreaming, for the Los Angeles School's A-List Book Club. So here she is reading the passage titled Gifted.
Everyone knows my sister is brilliant. The letters come home folded neatly inside official-looking envelopes that my sister proudly hands over to my mother. Odella has achieved. Odella has excelled at. Odella has been recommended to. Odella's outstanding performance in. She is gifted, we are told, and I imagine presence surrounding her. I am not gifted. When I read, the words twist, twirl across the page. When they settle, it is too late. The class has already moved on. I want to catch words one day. I want to hold them, then blow gently. Watch them float right out of my hands.
That's beautiful. And wow, what an inspiration, really, for any kid having trouble with reading right now, since that was your own story, right?
Mm-hmm. It was. I read very, very slowly. I've always read slowly. And I spend a lot of time with words, which makes sense as a writer, right? But there was no tolerance for the way I read back in the day. And I fear there's no tolerance for young people reading slowly today, which makes me sad.
And slow reading or not, you've written at least 30 books for children, teens, and adults. So there is a lot to keep track of. But I believe your most recent book is Before the Ever After, that came out last month for ages 10 and up. It's a novel in verse about a boy whose father is a former professional football player, now suffering from the brain damage that we've learned can result from sports like football in particular. You don't shy away from tough topics when talking to children and young adults. How have you figured out how to walk that line?
Well, I think that life doesn't shy away from tough topics. And I think we'd be lying to our young people if we made them believe that the world wasn't as it is. And I think as long as there is hope somewhere in the narrative, young people know they're going to be okay. And they want to engage in literature that is familiar, that where they can see some part of themselves in the narrative. So I really try to make sure the hope is there and tell a good story that will engage them and introduce them to characters that they'll fall in love with and want to follow through with.
Have you always written in verse? What does that structure add to the storytelling that prose sometimes can't offer?
Well, in this case, it's a book about memory in the same way that Brown Girl Dreaming was. And we know that memory comes in these small moments with all of this white space around it. So there's the unknown that white space represents. So it felt like, and in the case of Before the Ever After, you know, his father is losing his memory. And it would have been not true to write that book as a straight narrative, chapter one, chapter two, chapter three. Just as in the case of Brown Girl Dreaming, it would have felt false to write my memoir as a straight narrative, because that's not how life is lived. I haven't always written in verse. The first book I wrote in verse was a book called Locomotion. But before then, I was terrified of poetry. I mean, I think for a long time, I thought it was this secret code and that only a few people had the password to. And as I read more and more poetry, I began to understand that it wasn't that it was a party we were all invited to. And I really try to bring that to the book so that young people aren't afraid to step into a novel written in verse.
Have you thought about writing about this pandemic, either now or someday? So many lives disrupted, if not worse. But for your audience of younger readers, when a few months is such a big part of their lived experience.
Yeah, I haven't thought about writing it because, as you know, I have a 12-year-old and an 18-year-old, so I am right up in it. Yeah. And I think that what I can do is provide narratives that speak to a time where we live through something like this so that they know that we can survive it. I just wrote a picture book about two kids who go into their heads and fly away. And it's based on the idea that Black people could fly, and that's how they left enslavement, right? They inside their heads, they weren't enslaved. And so I think that's the same. That's not talking specifically about this pandemic, but it's talking about the way we can have freedom inside such a place where we feel so locked in.
What are you working on now? Anything you can reveal is next?
Oh my goodness. I am actually working on a lot. I'm working on a middle grade book. I just finished the screenplay for Red at the Bone that I'm doing with Lena Waithe's company, Hillman Grad. I just finished I'm writing a mini series based on another book called Behind You. I think I can't say yet who I'm doing that with, but it's somebody we all love. And I'm writing poetry and trying to keep a daughter who's at her first year at Howard sane and a son who's in seventh grade sane. but a lot of good things are happening, and I'm just glad we're safe.
That's great. Do you think, as a last thought, you know, the publishing industry has faced a lot of criticism for the lack of representation of people of color in its ranks and in the authors that make it to bookstores. Has your success opened doors for others that you can actually see?
I hope so. I really hope so. I do see a change. I mean, organizations like We Need Diverse Books and First Book, people are really showing that there are books out there and there need to be more books. One thing I'm doing with the MacArthur is starting an organization called Baldwin for the Arts, where we're building a residency for BIPOC artists. This is visual artists, writers, and composers to create art. And I think that's a way to really get artists into the world so publishers can't say, well, they're not there.
That's great. Jacqueline Woodson's latest book is the novel in verse, Before the Ever After. Congratulations on your Genius Award.
Thank you, Brian. Nice talking to you again.
Today, we wrap it up with Princeton biological chemist Mohammed Syed Syamdost, who was honored, to quote what the MacArthur Foundation had to say, for investigating synthesis of novel molecules with therapeutic properties and expediting discovery of new antibiotics, unquote. Congratulations. Welcome back. And thank you for joining us today and sharing your genius, doctor.
Thank you very much, Brian. Thanks for having me.
And as I said, the MacArthur Grant is for exceptional creativity. And all this week, we've been hearing from artists, like writers and filmmakers and singers. So I'm glad they also recognize the creativity of scientists, especially now that we're counting on scientists more than ever. But were you surprised, therefore, to get this?
I think one is always surprised. This is one of the awards where you don't know you're being nominated, you don't know you're being considered, and the first time you find out is when they make the phone call to tell you you won. And so, absolutely, I was very, very pleasantly surprised.
So your work, I see, is with fighting bacterial infections, not viruses. So while you aren't on the front lines of SARS-CoV-2 research, the threat from antibiotic-resistant bacteria is not a small problem by any means, and that's what you've made advances in. Can you explain a little bit about your work to a lay audience?
Yes, absolutely. So it turns out, bacterial infections, infectious disease in general, is obviously one of the major health threats of the 21st century. And it turns out that what we have used to fight bacteria, bacterial infections, are molecules that come from bacteria, innocuous soil-dwelling bacteria that we use to extract molecules from and then fight those infections that occur inside our bodies. And what we learned around 15 years ago, and I say we as a community, is that these antibiotics, these low-hanging antibiotics, had already been picked. And we learned that there is probably another 5 or 10 times as many antibiotics that these soil-dwelling bacteria can synthesize that conventional methods were not able to access and are not able to access. And so what we've been interested in and what we've developed is a method that allows us to access these otherwise difficult to reach or difficult to identify antibiotics and then to sort of examine their properties as potential therapeutic agents.
And I see you've talked about this concept of how molecules talk. So explain for us how your invention of a method called HITES works and how it's making a big difference in figuring out more about the language of molecules and how they communicate.
Right. So, bacteria essentially communicate with the language of small molecules, with a chemical language. You can think of the molecules that they exchange among each other as words, and you can think of the function of those molecules as meanings. And so this really constitutes a chemical language with which bacteria interact and communicate and compete with their environment. And so this gets a little sort of deeper into our method, but what we realized is that we needed to coax bacteria into producing these antibiotics that they clearly could synthesize, but were not synthesizing under normal growth conditions. And so what we did was bombard them with different types of natural molecules and see which ones they reacted to by synthesizing their repertoire of antibiotics. So it was essentially getting into a conversation, if you will, with the bacteria. And again, if you will, talking them into producing the antibiotics that they can.
And I see where, aside from talkative molecules, or in addition to them, you've also discovered fratricidal molecules. Uh-oh.
Right.
What does that mean at the molecular level?
It's something we're still trying to figure out. This was also surprising. You know, it turns out aside from molecules that are meant to kill your competitor, bacteria also make molecules to kill their own kind. And it really is a exercise that allows a bacterial population to remain fit. It essentially, sacrifices, sibling cells, frees up their genetic information, which is then used by the surviving population to make it more genetically diverse. That's what we think is going on, but it's really early days in the research.
So what disease do you think your research is most likely to be productive at discovering something that can fight it?
Right. So right now we're following up on some nice hits that we've seen, or nice therapeutic molecules that we've isolated against Clostridium difficile, or C. diff. That's one of the infections that occurs in the body when there's an imbalance in the gut microbiome.
Oh, good, because I know people who've had that, and it's no fun.
Yes,
and in fact,
exactly.
Ironically, as you work on antibiotics, that can be a side effect of antibiotics in some cases.
That's exactly right. And so, you know, our tools to fight C. diff infections are limited at the moment. And so that's one area that we are targeting.
I see you.
Another area, if I may add quickly,
please.
Another area that we're targeting is drug-resistant Neisseria, the causative agent of gonorrhea.
You've lived and studied around the world, I see, Iran, Germany, Australia, in this case, in this country, I should say, in Boston, and now Princeton. Do you find science to be a kind of universal language, or do you find, even within science, which is, you know, as kind of purely objective as anything you get, different styles?
I do find science is a universal language. I think, living in those countries, the significant benefit was, growing up with and experiencing different cultures. But the scientific language was constant. It was always happening. It was always one way, even if you didn't know the language of the country, it was one way to sort of communicate and exchange with other scientists. So that I have certainly appreciated.
Do you have a dream discovery when you're working in the lab you run at Princeton?
That's a very interesting question. I think the dream is always to find the truth, right? Find the truth in what you're doing. I think it's a little dangerous to have a dream discovery, because then you're predisposing yourself to certain things and perhaps blocking out other things. And so when you're working in the lab, I think you're trying to be as open as possible and find what the experiment and what the system is trying to teach you, is trying to tell you, and be open to any surprises that you might find. Just as an example, the fratricidal molecule is something we would have never dreamt of discovering, right? But it's certainly something we found because we were open to the idea that that is a function that we could identify.
And we're going to leave it there. Thank you, Princeton biological chemist Mo Sayed Sayamdos. And we thank all the new MacArthur Genius Grant winners for coming on, all five of them who came on this week. We're actually going to add one on Monday because that's how many there are. So a lot of New York, New Jersey, Connecticut area geniuses newly minted this week. And Dr. Sayed Sayamdos, thank you very much for being part of this series.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Brian.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.